Thank you, John. Good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this AFRI Health series of webinars. My name is Emilia Nurmalmed. I am professor at UAM at Eduardo Mondlane University in Maputo, Mozambique, and a member of the governing committee of AFRI Health. So we hope you are all safe and healthy where you are. Thank you. Our first presenter is Professor Mohsin Siddat. He is medical doctor. He has a master's degree from London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in Infectious Disease. And he has his PhD from University of Melbourne in Australia. And he is our past dean at the Faculty of Medicine, Eduardo Mondlane University. So this time it is a pleasure to have him here, where he is going to present the Mozambique experience in terms of response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So Professor Mohsin Siddat, thank you so much for accepting our invitation to come and share your experience, the Mozambique experience, and from now you can present. You have about 15 minutes for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Emilia. Good day to all, and hope all are safe. It's my pleasure to be on this webinar and present my thoughts related to Mozambique. So far, Mozambique has been successful in flattening the curve, in avoiding huge number of COVID cases, and also avoiding mortality. So I would start by just presenting some very selected demographic and health indicators. As you can see on the screen, that I have highlighted infant mortality under 5, and maternal mortality. All of them are relatively high still, but I can say that in the past 30 years, we have been making considerable progress. And I've also highlighted at the bottom, and I apologize, the slides are in Portuguese, but you can... Yes?
Can you put on slideshow? It's...
I am in slideshow here.
White screen.
Can you see?
I can see the white screen. Okay.
Even me.
You are not able to see the slides?
Yes, we are.
I was saying that I've also highlighted the ratio of doctors per inhabitants. And you can see at the bottom here that we have about 12 doctors for 100,000 inhabitants. For urban area, you have only 2 doctors for the same number of people in rural areas. So a huge inequity here. I have also included a slide on the distribution of health facilities across the country to show and highlight the inequity in distribution of health facilities, where Maputo City and province are well catered in terms of health services and healthcare access compared to others. But because this is just to give you an idea of the challenge that a country with this level of health system faces when we have to deal with pandemics like COVID. This slide was made about 2 days ago. We are now on 65 days of our pandemic here, and we have about 213 confirmed cases. And unfortunately, we had one death about 2 days ago. Overall, the epidemic distribution is concentrated mainly in Maputo and in the northern province called Cabo Delgado. We have a few cases spread around other provinces, but they are very few. The majority of the cases are concentrated in these two big provinces. As you can see in this slide next. So Maputo City and Maputo Province concentrates the majority of cases, and we had huge number of cases in Cabdevielle. These cases are related to clusters of people who became positive and their contacts became positive. I should mention here that due to constraints in the capacity we have in terms of lab and in terms of the availability of tests, the tests are done in selective way. However, we are implementing the what we call screening tool, and it's a field epidemiological field tool, and we have screened more than 700,000 people, and from these we have only tested about 9,000 now people for HIV, from which 213 were positive. As you see, our cases are growing slowly. However, we start implementing confinement measures, public health measures, since March, around mid-March, with social distancing and enhancing hygienic individual and collective, isolating cases that we identified and quarantine contacts and travelers coming from countries affected by COVID. From April, and we started from 1st April, we started another phase, which we call state of emergency, declared for 30 days, which was renewed from 1st of May, and it's going to last until 30th of May. Most probably this emergency state will be renewed, particularly now that the cases are increasing. So if you look at the graph here, it seems paradoxical that you implement a state of emergency where the confinement is tighter, but then you start having cases. But these cases are related to people coming from abroad. We are following the guidelines of WHO in the measures the country is implementing. So when we start implementing measures, we start from level 2. Now, currently, we are in the level 3, and we are in this level in the past 56 days. Mozambique has deployed lots of health personnel, particularly residents in public health, students from the master program in field epidemiology, and also other health workers who are trained and are doing the contact tracing and also are involved in the testing. The Ministry of Health has put lots of different kind of supporting tools, such as the call center, and you can see here at the bottom different numbers of call centers that different numbers of telephone that they can using different providers, and also in the internet there is a COVID-19 risk self-assessment, so anyone can see if the someone needs or not individually a test. And the ministry also has been providing regular updates for the what's happening and preparing. So far, I have a mistake here. Well, anyway, there is. Let me remove this thing here in the middle. Okay. So anyway, as I said at the beginning, we were more or less successful in flattening the curve, but our curve, perhaps, we were very tight in the measures that we implemented. So our curve is quite low, much lower than our capacity currently. However, now we are, perhaps we are very at the very beginning of our curve. And we are now starting to see the numbers of cases increasing very rapidly. But we are not sure how long we can keep these measures, because these measures, of course, have impact in the society, particularly in the livelihood of the people. So I have drawn some other curves that are possible. If we relax, perhaps if we don't relax that much, we still can be under our health system capacity. But if we relax more, we can actually increase our capacity. Anyway, after about 60 days of confinement measures, there are still very many questions that we have. So, for example, we use different models, mathematical models, to estimate what could happen, and based on that, how should we prepare? But we have low, mid, and high estimates. And even taking the low estimates, the investment required is huge because of our current health system. So there are lots of challenges in preparing ourselves. Up to now, we are about 50% prepared for the lower estimates. The country is also very unequal in terms of the health system coverage, access to healthcare, etc. And it becomes always difficult to decide where to put the resources and how to mobilize the resources and how quickly we can mobilize these resources. Due to time, I'm going to pass and I will be available to then answer a question. We have to keep in mind that once we have infected people, all of us are susceptible, and then we will have cases. But if we are able, like other countries, like Korea, for example, South Korea, to trace quickly or to detect quickly cases and then treat them or isolate them and then trace their contacts, we can quickly also control the epidemic occurring. So it has been important, as I mentioned, more than 700,000 people were contacted, screened to with the tool that was developed by the Ministry of Health, based also in international guidelines. And from this, about 9,000 people were tested, and those that were positive were isolated, and those that were contacts, different types of contact, they were quarantined. So there is still a big challenge for Mozambique to identify cases. This is because of our limited capacity in terms of lab and also in terms of availability of tests. Yeah. We are also not sure why we are not having that much cases, why our cases are not being very transmissible, or if they are transmissible, why we are not detecting these cases. We are not sure. And perhaps our current contact strategy is feasible when we have a limited epidemic, but perhaps it won't be very feasible once we have many cases and once the cases spread along across the country. So there are still, and I apologize, my 15 minutes have passed, but I want to close with this slide that the containment is necessary, although all of the socio-economic side effects it produces. But if we want to be able to care for people who get sick, we need to control, we need to be tough in the measures we implement. There will be pressure for the government to relax. We don't know about herd immunity. If we are very strict, how are we going to be able to expose our people and benefit from herd immunity? Because the vaccine is still quite far. If the vaccine comes quicker, we can keep maintaining the tighter measures, but then it cannot be eternal. We need to have, in short term, some kind of solution. We don't have yet any exit strategy, and I don't think the countries that are looking at it have good examples yet. We have to wait and see successful examples, and there are lots of evidence. We are learning every day, lots of new knowledge coming, and we are learning every day. And as we learn, also we adjust our strategy and our measures. And I think, although the times are uncertain, gradually we are becoming certain of certain things. And many thanks. I apologize for going beyond my time. Professor Emile, I'm sorry. My time is expired.
Okay. Thank you very much, Prof. Siddharth. Is Beatrice online?
Yes, Professor, I'm here, but apologize. Move to the third speaker because we have some challenge with the PDF. The time for us to find solution. Move to the third.
Okay, thank Please. You. Yeah. Okay, thank you, Mike. Are you ready?
Yes, good morning. I'm ready. Happy to present
that. Introduce yourself and it's all yours. Thank you.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Reed. I'm an infectious disease doctor at the University of California, San Francisco, and I know many of you from our shared work on STRIPE, the HIV training program. Thank you, Professor Siddharth, for such a fantastic presentation. It's amazing to see what you've done in Mozambique. So kudos to your team for all of their work on that. Thank you, Jean, for the invitation to speak today. My hope is to just briefly talk to you about the work that our team have been doing on contact tracing in San Francisco. As many of you know, we were working feverishly on STRIPE-related projects until February, when limitation on travel meant that we had to stay at home. And in that moment, I was asked to support colleagues at San Francisco Department of Public Health in their efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 here in California. And what I thought I'd do is talk a little bit about what I have done in that capacity to support San Francisco Department of Public Health contact tracing program. I'm sensitive to the fact that at the University of California, we are not doing the contact tracing. We're supporting our amazing colleagues in the Department of Public Health to do that. And kudos to those folks for doing an incredible job here in San Francisco. But briefly, and I'm sure you all know this, the reason we do contact tracing is that through the process of identifying infectious cases, reaching out to their contacts, we can slow the spread of COVID-19 across our communities, breaking the chain of transmission, saving lives. And that's the rationale for this this work. Moreover, there's increasing amounts of excellent science to support the role of contact tracing in containing COVID-19. And I just highlight here a study from Shenzhen, China, where they illustrated that if you compared folks that were engaged through a contact tracing program with those that were detected passively, you could clearly illustrate that the time to hospitalization, the time to isolation, time to testing were all quicker if you reached people through a contact tracing program. Lots of other research demonstrating the importance of this public health intervention. But one thing that's became clear to us in San Francisco through our work here, and I think it's been documented in literature around the world, including a nice summary from the African Union, is that in order to do this well, there needs to be a scale, an increase in the number of people that are available to do contact tracing simply because of the human resource requirements. And so as we've thought about this here in San Francisco and things that I just quickly want to highlight with you in the next 10 minutes, the importance of a digital solution in order to do that, the role of, you know, human resource mobilization and who here in San Francisco we've been able to mobilize towards this work. And then the piece around training, which the team that I work with here in San Francisco have done a phenomenal job to implement. So from a digital point of view, from an informatics point of view, I won't spend too much time on this, but it quickly became clear in early February that we needed to move beyond using paper-based tools to document cases and to track contacts. And we needed a tool that would allow us to scale rapidly, especially because most of our public health workforce was being encouraged to work from home. So we needed some means to be able to enable those folks that were doing this work to work from home. We looked into a number of different solutions, and at the time, the best solution that was available to us was one developed by the company called Dimagi, who some of you may be familiar with because they do a lot of work around digital case management in places like sub-Saharan Africa. I won't spend any time talking about the tool except for that it's a simple way for our contact tracers to enter data onto a digital platform using a web-based case management tool so that we're able to track individuals, both cases and then contacts, even as our workforce is distributed, working remotely. Let me briefly talk to you about the workforce piece of what we've come to sort of learn from the experience. As I mentioned, there's been need to massively expand the workforce here in San Francisco in order to support tracking and care for individuals with COVID as well as their contacts. And the public health workforce has already been working night and day, and so there was a pressing need to find new people that could jump into this role. And this has been documented in the public, in the media here in San Francisco, you know, at great length, because I think people have found this to be a really fascinating story. Encourage you to read any of these articles if you're interested. But very very simply, we guesstimated in the first place the number of contact tracers that we thought we would need in a projected future state when the cases increase. Just as in Mozambique, since early March, there have been implemented strict shelter-in-place orders here in San Francisco, so people aren't able to leave their homes. And in that setting, the number of contacts of each case have been relatively few, approximately 3 to 4 contacts per case. But look, we wanted to project into the future when we move beyond shelter-in-place and people are engaged in more activities again, what might that increase in the number of contacts per case being, what might the number of cases increase to, and therefore what might be the increased contact tracing human resource demand. And we guesstimate, and I won't go into these numbers in too much detail, that we need at least 100 and 100 to 150 individuals doing this work on a regular basis, on a daily basis. And therefore, we need to increase the size of our workforce now so that we can anticipate that future state. And so, in San Francisco, over the last 4 weeks, we've trained over 400 folks from both from the University of California and from across the city. And right now we have 140 people working a week on contact tracing. These include some staff from my university, but also furloughed civil servants from across the city, librarians, city attorneys, and other civil servants. All of these folks go through a 20-hour training program. We were asked by California Department of Public Health to scale this training program so that any Department of Public Health in the state could use these resources. And so we're actually now training between 500 and up to 3,000 trainees a week now, so that we can help the Department of Public Health across California to do this work. So folks learn about epidemiology, but they also learn important sort of communication skills, health coaching and motivation and interviewing skills that they might otherwise not be aware of if they're not coming from a public health or clinical background. I'm happy to talk about that in more detail if there's interest. So what does the workforce do? Well, again, I'm not going to spend too much time on this except to highlight that whenever there's a case, we as part of the workflow for case investigation, we elicit the names of all of the close contacts of that case. And the names of those close contacts are shared with my team, the contact tracing team, and we get on the phone and we reach all of those contacts. We do this digitally. We have small teams led by a team lead, and there are 5 tracers, and each of those teams is supported by a clinician. Those clinicians can be medical students or retired doctors or nurses, and their role is really to support technically the challenges that the tracers might have, questions that they might have. In the process of that contact tracing workflow, all of our tracers will screen the contacts for symptoms, and if they had symptoms, refer them for testing, and then we enroll them in a 14-day monitoring program where they receive a daily SMS. Recognizing that recognizing that putting people into quarantine if they don't have symptoms it places exacting demands on individuals, the need for to support food, etc. We also link contacts with social services support as necessary so that they're able to safely self-quarantine. And I highlight some of the resources that we make available to contacts who are asked to quarantine based on their exposure. So if necessary, they have access to quarantine rooms in hotels here in San Francisco, if they're food insecure, food, and then cleaning or medical supplies as appropriate. So what has our impact been to date? Well, the goal here in San Francisco is a lofty goal, that a 90-90-90-90 goal. I know that you've heard that motif before, but the goal is that through case investigation, we reach 90% of all the cases here in San Francisco, and we safely isolate 90% of those cases. Moreover, the goal is to reach 90% of all contacts and ensure that 90% of those contacts are safely placed into self-quarantine. So far, and this is just the contact tracing data, I'm not sharing the case investigation data. In terms of cases, we've reached over 1,200 cases in the city and recommended them for isolation. But we started the contact tracing work in earnest in early April. We've reached over 3,000. There have been over 3,000 contacts elicited by the case investigation team, and we've attempted to reach 77%. And we've reached 70% of all of those contacts. Many people don't have a phone number. So we have a special team, the enhanced contact tracing team, who go and look for phone numbers. And we've been able to reach 320 people without phone numbers by a number of different measures. So this is just to illustrate over time the impact of the team. And you can clearly see as we've scaled our workforce, as we've become more efficient at what we've been doing, we've been able to reach more of those contacts with the resources and information through our program. Clearly, reaching contacts as quickly as possible is sort of the name of the game. The sooner we can reach a contact and recommend that they quarantine, the quicker we can break that ongoing chain of transmission. And this is just a week-by-week plot of the speed with which our team has been able to reach contacts. And you can clearly see that since middle of May, we've been reaching all of our contacts in less than 24 hours. The efficiency, the ability to do that, reflects the fact that we now have a bigger team, but it also reflects the fact that we're seeing less cases here in San Francisco. And I think, you know, whether we're able to hold the line in terms of rapidly reaching cases, we'll have to see moving forward. So briefly, I want to keep the time. I just wanted to share a few lessons with you. One of the things that is heartbreaking here in San Francisco, truly heartbreaking, is how this epidemic has shed a light on profound social inequities in our city. Look, San Francisco is one of the wealthiest cities in the US, and yet COVID-19 has decimated certain populations here in the city, particularly the Latinx or Hispanic, Spanish-speaking population. And nearly 60% of all the contacts that we're reaching in San Francisco are primary Spanish-speaking. And here, as the table illustrates, across California, the vast majority of cases are Latinx, and nearly 70% of all deaths. And I think in terms of a lesson that we've learned is that we must ensure that our workforce, our contact tracing workforce, is informed by that demographic distribution. And so we've really put a priority on recruiting folks that are Spanish speaking and from the Hispanic, the Latinx community here in San Francisco. But moving forward, and I think this is a key lesson that we can learn from colleagues in Africa, you know, I think we need a new model for how we do contact tracing, leveraging community health workers and community-based organizations. My understanding is that in South Africa, you have over 28,000 community health workers doing screening and contact tracing. And similarly, in Tanzania, you're using health commandos, community health workers, to do the work of screening and contact tracing. I think we have a lot to learn from that here in SF. Second thing I thought would be useful as a lesson to be learned is that we have used a digital solution, but we have not so far employed a sort of a cell phone based tracking application, that, you know, the kind that has been in the news a lot. Using a digital solution has allowed us to scale rapidly, allowed our workforce to work remotely, but we're not using a tracking application that sort of uses Bluetooth technology to do this. lesson three, and this is an important one that I sort of want to pause and unpack for you. You know, we do not believe that contact tracing is a silver bullet. And even in countries where they have incredibly robust contact tracing programs like Singapore, they are still seeing outbreaks there. And I think many of those outbreaks are happening driven by inequities in access to care, overcrowding, et cetera. And certainly that's the case in San Francisco. One of the communities that has been hardest hit by COVID-19 is the homeless population. And so if we're to reach that population, we need to, you know, reach it with a more robust, expansive set of public health interventions in addition to contact tracing. And finally, the last sort of lesson I wanted to share, and I think this is where there's a real opportunity for AfriHealth and the STRIKE program to jump in. I think there's a real opportunity to transform to train and transform across our society. We've had the privilege through the STRIKE program and through the work that we're doing with SFDPH to train a lay workforce of people to understand the complexities of public health and the importance of contact tracing. And that's been an exhilarating and profoundly exciting opportunity. But I think it also has enabled us to communicate with a wider section of society the importance of public health, the importance of a safety net, the importance of sort of a welfare infrastructure to protect our marginalized communities. And my hope is that, you know, we can stand up a pandemic workforce academy, perhaps in collaboration with AfriHealth, so that we can leverage these training resources to a wider audience. So I'll end here with a sort of a somber note. Look, with humility, I look to some of the amazing work that you're doing in Africa and just think, wow, there are so many lessons that can be learned, and reflect with some sadness that in the US, our leadership has been characterized by obfuscation, by belligerence, and not empathy. And I look to you all as leaders in this moment, because I think we have a great deal to offer. A great deal to learn from you. One sort of reflection from our own experience here in San Francisco is that whilst at a country level, the US is not leading in this moment, I'm heartened by the fact that I live in a city which was the first place on the planet to set up an HIV clinic, which undertook some of the first ever HIV clinical trials and has led in the movement to end the HIV epidemic. And my hope is that San Francisco can partner with you in leading in ending COVID-19. The work that has happened in San Francisco has happened not only through the incredible tireless efforts of the STRIKE team, many of whom you already know, but because of the decisive leadership and incredible hard work of colleagues at our Department of Public Health, and I just wanted to honor them here. Jean, over to you. I'm happy to answer questions whenever works.
Thank you, Mike. That was fantastic. Really a lot of thought for discussion in the QA session. So let's Beatrice, team in DRC Lubumbashi.
Yes, we are ready.
Are you able to share your slide?
Yes. Please,
okay.
Share. No. That's okay. Done.
HERSA supported ICAP RRHS project in Lubumbashi, DRC. And she's going to share with us just in 10 minutes. The activity on sensitization, screening, and contact tracing in DRC. It's up to you, Beatrice.
Thank you very much for giving me voice. We are here on team, DRC team in Lubumbashi. We want to share with you how we experience interprofessional COVID-19 in community sensitization, screening and contact tracing in Lubumbashi. First, apologize for how English accent, because we are a Francophone country, but we'll do our effort to be understand. Okay. In our agenda, we have 67 points. The first is the introduction and eco objective, participant community sensitization, and screening on COVID, contact tracing in Lubumbashi and partnership. So let us go to the introduction in this introduction, we want to talk how ICAP in Lubumbashi via RHS team is using Eco Project or Eco Platform to be involved in COVID-19 activities. So here's the introduction is saying, showing the PEPFAR DRC funding for evidence-based and impact measurable interventions that will strengthen human health resources in order to address health challenges such as HIV/AIDS and other comorbidities, for example, TB and COVID-19. So why ICAP installed ECHO in Lubumbashi? The first cause was, or the first reason was the human health resource challenges include inadequate staffing and limited capacity, which impede the delivery of quality HIV service in DRC. So to overcome challenges, ICAP at Columbia University began project ECHO in October 2019 in three sites in Okatanga. So these three sites is like one hub. Here we are in the hub, and we have two spots. One spot is in rural area, and another spot is in Inilu. Inilu is the University of Lubumbashi. And we are planning a possibility of extension in 2020 to more sites in DRC. So the main objective of the ECHO project was to establish a community of practice for the continuous improvement of quality results of services and HIV healthcare and other comorbidities in provincial priority sites. For us, the priority site has the border areas, mostly in Zambia border. So we have, as I was talking, one hub at SNCC. SNCC is the big hospital, general hospital of reference from the government, DRC government. We are here. And then two spots, the one is Kasenga, who is the rural area. They are connected. And then Inilu, last spot, like University of Lubumbashi School of Medicine. And this ECHO project with the NWH support and some stakeholders like ICAP and the others locally here in Lubumbashi. Okay, finally, look at how a picture we're showing how students and the community are involved in the HIV, ECHO, or COVID, like comorbidities. That is a picture related to ECHO in DRC. In the middle, we have the rector of University of Lubumbashi to show his involvement on ECHO activities. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Beatrice Lukeni. I really like the interprofessional aspect of your project, and so this is quite some lesson to learn, not only in Africa, but probably other places in the world. So we left about 10 minutes of discussion. So there have been some questions on the chat room. So we have a contribution or participation from people, participant from Lusophone, Portuguese speaking. So so some of the speaker, especially Prof. Sidat, if you want to reply in Portuguese, that's fine. And just a brief translation in English. So I'm going to start first with Prof. Sidat. There is some audience want to know a bit more about your strategy for, you know, contact tracing and testing. Why, who do you decide to test? Is only symptomatic or asymptomatic? And what's your capacity for testing in Mozambique? Maybe you can start, we can start with you.
Thank you, Prof. Lashega. Perhaps start with saying that all of those that were tested
about 75 to 80% asymptomatic. Second, we do case limit investigation, and we also interview all those that were in contact, immediate contact or indirect contact with the cases. And these people are subject to they are subject to an interview that is carried out with the scoring system, and then based on the result they decide to test or not to test. So as I said in my presentation, unfortunately very quickly, we have interviewed more than 700,000, but only tested about 9,000 people. So this is also because availability of tests is limited. We have a limited number of tests, which is growing gradually as the support from our partners increase, we get some more tests. Currently, there was only one lab doing tests, but there are in place measures to include other labs with capacity, like molecular biology labs that different universities have. They will be involved. The research centers that have labs, they are going to be involved as well. So they are currently being prepared to also do the testing for us. So we are doing only PCR tests. We are not doing serological tests yet.
Okay, thank you.
This answer.
Yes, that's answer. Prof. Raid, so there is a question from audience about also strategy of testing in San Francisco. Who do you test? What indication of testing? And also on the serology test, what's the status in the other place of the planet? And also there've been some a number of questions about the racial inequality and what is driving that in San Francisco and in general in the US, and how you're addressing that in that part of the world.
Okay, so in terms of eligibility criteria for testing in San Francisco, there's a long list. Essentially, anybody who presents with symptoms consistent with COVID-19 can get tested, but we prioritize those that are vulnerable, coming from congregate living settings, et cetera. Amongst contacts, we actually propose that all contacts should be eligible for testing regardless of symptoms. And in fact, our goal is that when we reach contacts, we recommend that they get a test at the time of contact engagement, and then ideally, again, at the end of their quarantine period. So we're testing people sometimes, or certainly the hope is twice within that 14-day period, given our concern that some will go on to develop symptoms. We are not using serological tests here at the University of California in standard care for contacts or in our public health work in support of the Department of Public Health. Certainly in the inpatient setting, I practice as an infectious disease doctor. We are using those tests when there's a false negative PCR test in somebody who seems to have classic symptoms. But this serological testing is not part of our sort of a public health approach here in San Francisco at the moment. I think that's informed by the fact that we just don't have enough data to know how to use those tools. And then to your question about why are we seeing such profound differences in different racial and ethnic groups. Look, I think it sort of speaks to larger socioeconomic drivers of inequity in our society here in San Francisco. Certainly in our city, the Hispanic or Latinx community are less likely to have access to healthcare, more likely to be uninsured, also more likely to be undocumented and therefore fearful of accessing health services. And in terms of the worst sequelae of disease, that population are also a population that have higher levels of obesity, higher levels of specific comorbidities, including diabetes and cardiovascular disease, which puts them at risk for the worst consequences of COVID-19. I don't think there's any genetic mediation of this. I think that the fact that we're seeing such high levels really reflects the broader socioeconomic disparities in the US and in San Francisco in particular.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Another question from Peter Kilmax. Can you talk more about your metric, which I like also sound familiar from somewhere, and what the percentage of cases are coming from non-contact using your metrics of 90,
90, 90, 90? Yeah. So, you know, we have a couple of sort of cascades of metrics that are really informed by, you know, the indicators that we use for tracking STDs and HIV here in the US and in San Francisco. So we're looking at the numbers of cases that are identified, the number of cases that are reached, the number of cases that have at least one contact, and then the number of contacts that are reached, that are identified through that process, the number of contacts that are reached, and then the number of contacts that are monitored through the quarantine period. I'm happy to share those indicators with anybody that's interested. And the targets, the 90-90-90 targets, are sort of aspirational, but as you said, John, you have a sense of where they come from. One sort of pain point for us right now is that we're not easily able to track how many cases are linked to a contact. I think that's Peter's second question. That data is sort of in our system in theory, but we've not been able to use it effectively to establish networks. And so that's sort of something that we are sort of intensively trying to characterize with our data set, but has been a pain point for us.
Thank you, Mike. That's very clear. Back to our team in Lubumbashi, there is several questions about how you deal with issue about stigma and how the behavior, how the community react to COVID and how your project address that. So it will be interesting to hear from your experience and how your project is making a difference. So Beatrice and the team in DRC.
Thank you very much for your question. Really, there is a stigma here in Lubumbashi, even in other areas in the world. But how an ECHO project is using via training to explain to the people that we have to avoid stigma and people have to be open via how a community health workers to select some people who are presenting the symptom, the sign of COVID symptom, and to come with them in the health facilities. And the stigma is being reduced by the training to sensitize community. So we have to avoid, because everybody can be, considered by this disease. So we are going, we are moving forward on this, and to by the training and sensitization.
Yeah. Thank you, Beatrice. So we're running out of time. I'm gonna pass to my co-moderator Emilia, maybe to make some comment or quick question, and then to close up.
Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone, and special thanks to the presenters. I think all presentations were able to put us all together and share different experiences. One issue that reminds is about my request to Mike, if you can share the models that you have developed on COVID. And having said that, I hand to my co-moderator, John Eshega.
Thank you, Emilia. So let me thank everyone and the speakers. They did a terrific job, and it's really always interesting on our AFRI Health to really to share experience and learn from each other, from the West to the South, North South, and Francophone, Portuguese, Anglophone community. So this has been very learning experience, and we're going to keep continuing doing this. And I would like also to thank all the participants for their really sharp question, and also all our partners who are connecting every month for this webinar, for their support. Thank you, everyone. And we will post the slide on the AfriHealth website. Please visit us. And then we have a blog, COVID blog, where we continue our discussion. So if some of your questions were not answered, there will be, we can answer it on the blog. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful end of the week. Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Thank you.